Good afternoon and welcome to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH. We are streaming live on the KTTH smartphone app. If you don't have that app, you should download it immediately. Another day, another outrageous crime involving a juvenile. That's what's trending.
What's trending? Crime.
According to the Seattle Police Department, they arrested a 17-year-old and a 22-year-old. Both male. Both, they say, were involved in an armed carjacking at a drive-through ATM. They've got the surveillance footage. It's pretty terrifying if you're the victim. 40-year-old man. He went to the ATM to do what you do at an ATM. Collect cash. And it was at that point, police say, these two pulled up to him, then went up to him, pulled out a handgun, demanded his keys, his cell phone, the money that was coming out of the ATM. The victim did what you're supposed to do in a situation like this. Comply. So they end up taking his car. He was able to call 911 using someone else's phone. And SPD ended up being able to track down these two kids in that car. They tried to pull them over. They were all like, nah, I'm gonna keep driving. I hear you still can't follow us for at least the next couple weeks, right? But they were all like, oh no, see, when you did an armed carjacking, you gave us, under the law, the ability to chase. So they end up going on a chase. It ends up in Mercer Island. I don't know why they thought they would just go to Mercer Island and all of a sudden they would get out. Like, really?
It's an island.
What's going to happen? You're just going to get stuck in traffic. Where are you going? Seriously, like, why would you take I-90?
Yeah, not really the best escape route.
They're still doing construction there. You got to go in the tunnels.
No one said criminals were smart. But.
Well, yeah, that's definitely true. So police say they found a handgun, which whoever was in the passenger side of the car ended up throwing out of the window. That's what they say. They were able to track that down, and they ended up making an arrest.
Got a man running. We're running through this church here.
You're going to get shot. Get off the ground. Get off the ground.
Get on the ground right now.
Get on the ground. One at gunpoint. Oh, yeah. I surrendered.
All I heard from the guy was dog and
dog. He said, I think he was saying, I'm surrendering.
Oh, I love the whole idea of going on a chase. And then when they forcefully put you in handcuffs, why are you being so rude? What are you doing here? I'm not resisting. I'm surrendering. Gosh, what do you want from me? Well, I mean, we wanted you not to drive off originally.
Throw a gun out the window and...
Why are you yelling at me? You know, if you asked nicely, I probably would have complied. Did you say please? Oh, they always have that weird attitude. And it's almost like they're shocked that they're being arrested, which isn't weird to me in this area because many people get shocked each and every time someone actually not only gets arrested, but then booked and charged. Now, because a gun was involved here, they'll be charged. I don't know if they'll spend any time, meaningful time, in juvenile detention. Don't have information yet about their backgrounds, but I'm willing to bet, and we don't have to do this as Jason tells the future because I know I'm going to be right, has a criminal history, at least one of them. When you're 17 years old and 20 years old and you allegedly have a gun and allegedly commit a carjacking, yeah, you've done something before. This might have been your first carjacking, but you've done something before. Like, I don't know, illegally possess that gun, for starters. The gun is probably going to be stolen. That's my guess. I'm sure they were in a car that was stolen. Obviously, the second part of the car was stolen. That was, yeah. This is going to continue to happen and happen again and happen again and happen again. And rather than focus all of our attention on some of the policies that are responsible, because I feel like most of us probably already know the policies responsible, let's focus on what will happen next, which is they'll get in front of a judge And that judge will decide whether or not to release these kids with electronic home monitoring, which does not work, or make the right decision and put them in juvenile detention or keep them in juvenile detention. And 9 times out of 10, they will be released on their own personal recognizance plus electronic home monitoring. They do that with kids who are accused in drive-by shootings. They do that in cases of violent crimes because they believe that, especially if the kid happens to be Black or Latino, that by going through the criminal justice system, they are at a disadvantage when they are older. And that part's true. That part's 100% correct. So is the white kid and the Asian kid and the Native American kid and the kid you think might be Latino but is actually Asian or vice versa. Like Peyton, my former producer, can never tell. Everyone's all like, is he Latino or is he Asian? They also have a hard time. I would prefer not to subject anybody to a hard time down the line for an indiscretion as a kid, such as stealing a bag of chips at the corner store. I have zero problem burdening these kids if they are armed and committing a carjacking. Now, I think we can all do better and we would all be better off by pushing for meaningful therapy and restorative justice behind bars, actually taking this seriously, not sending them to, what's the school in Chehalis, the green something school. Don't send them to Echo Glen unless you're going to give them the resources that they need in order to fully help these kids. They can be saved. And look, no matter what happens here, they will be out of jail at some point, right? Just looking at the schedule for them, sentencing, scheduling, guidelines, all that stuff. They're not going to spend very much time in jail here, even if they're fully convicted and we throw the book at them. Because throwing the book, if it doesn't have any pages, courtesy of Democrats who tore them all up, doesn't really matter. That was a good analogy. Put that down in my book. That was a good one. Technically, it was a metaphor.
Right? Yeah.
I didn't say like or as. So at the end of the day, when they're there, what are we doing to ensure that they're on the right track? And if we don't pay close attention to them and give them the resources they need, well, then guess what? They get released as a 24-year-old or a 27-year-old, whatever it is, maybe sometimes a 17-year-old, 21-year-old. And then they just return to a life of crime because we didn't help them. I'm not for just putting people in jail unless they're truly evil and will never, ever, ever, ever come out. I don't care about them, frankly. I'll be totally honest. Don't care. But I do care about a 17-year-old or a 20-year-old. And even though they're directly to blame for these allegations, they're innocent until proven guilty. But let's just presume for the sake of the argument that they caught the guys. While they're responsible, they're also victims, most likely, of something that happened earlier in their childhood, including coming from a broken home, which we're not supposed to talk about, because that's apparently racist for some reason, but you know, everything's racist, I guess. We should be spending a lot more time talking about the importance of families. We don't. Every once in a while you'll get, we need more community resources. Yeah, that's true. I'd like to see more resources going into communities to keep people from going down that wrong path. Sure. Y'all don't seem to spend the money very wisely. Instead, you give it to these nonprofit groups that are truly just awful. You're not giving them to worthwhile causes. You're giving them to police and prison abolitionist groups. And then you're shocked that the work that they do isn't actually doing anything to get at the underlying cause here. Look, it's not easy solving these issues. It's not. It's made worse. It's made more difficult when you've got really bad policies and bad judges who don't want to be judgy. You got judges who are not judgmental here. They make things worse, but we could be doing a lot of the other stuff way better, and we're choosing not to. And part of the reason why we're not, especially from a conservative perspective, why we're not focusing all of our attention there, because you have the immediate emergency of the bad policies. Imagine if we didn't have those horrible policies and judges who don't want to put people in jail. Imagine if the system actually worked, what we could then focus on to make it even better. But we can't, because not enough of us vote for the right people. But what do we have coming up soon?
An election.
Oh, yeah. And people can do what?
Vote.
Okay. And not just vote, but also do what?
Vote for different people.
Okay. But what else can they do? Say, coordinate with campaigns and pitch them to other people.
Coordinate with campaigns and pitch them to other people.
I would have been a little bit more enthusiastic, but yes, you're correct. You can be doing a little bit more. Everyone, let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Weatherpocalypse Mageddon.
Weatherpocalypse Mageddon. I feel like someone printed out the show sheet before they were supposed to.
Possible. Likely? Certain?
Mm-hmm. I want to do the Israel one.
Oh, okay.
Should we do that again because of your incompetence?
Let me,
God, he's panicking again.
Yeah, we can do it.
Okay. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Woke madness.
Well, now I kind of want to do the emergency drought story. You got me in the mood for that one. No, I'm going to stick with what I was going to. So I've got a story out right now, an editorial over at FoxNews.com. I actually have two out right now at FoxNews.com. But the one that was published today was about what happened on Monday. All of those protests, all of those lunatics who decided to go out and stop traffic, stop people getting to SeaTac Airport, stop people from going to O'Hare, stop people from getting to work who had to cross the Golden Gate Bridge. And in the coverage, a lot of the focus, rightly so, understandably so, is on the fact that these are anti-Semites. We focus on that. But the truth is, while they hate Jews and hate Israel, that's not what this is about. It seems like it, but it's not. This is about capitalism. That's all that this is about. They weren't peaceful protesters who cared about Palestinian lives. No, they're chaotic, radical extremists who want to bring down capitalism. They use that sleeping dragon technique where protesters handcuff themselves within PVC pipes, which makes it very difficult sometimes for police to handle them. They wanted to be there for a long time. They wanted to stop the economy for a long time. And this is precisely what it is that they did during the BLM movement. They took advantage of a larger cause that everyone they thought seemed to be on board with or enough, where people were really passionate, and then use that as an opportunity to radicalize a whole bunch of people and push them in a certain direction. Because people who are inspired by this movement to march, they're not going to do the organizing themselves. The professionals do it. And that's where they come in. When you look specifically at what it is they say, and I mean actually going to their website, looking at the language they use, it's pretty clear. What happened in San Francisco and Seattle and Chicago, it was formed by a group called A15, April 15th, that's what it is. But what they were calling their tactic was the A15 economic blockade. Their website talks about how it targets the global economy and how the global economy, particularly capitalism, which they believe to be oppressive, is, quote, complicit in genocide. They actively seek to, quote, block the arteries of capitalism and jam the wheels of production. That's pretty clear, yes? We all on the same page with that? I mean, there's no different interpretation.
I think they made their point.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear, but just in case it isn't. Quote, there is a sense on the streets in this recent and unprecedented movement for Palestine that escalation has become necessary. There is a need to shift from symbolic actions to those that cause pain to the economy. That's all that this is about. And that is why you're seeing more and more and more young people signing up for this stuff. These are disillusioned people. These are the baristas. These are the corporate America folks who are just absolutely sick and tired of that kind of lifestyle. They've been taught to hate it, and they blame capitalism. So they get more involved. And it just so happens that right now, the overt focus is on Israel. to the point where you've got folks who are chanting on college campuses for a genocide against Jews while saying that they're anti-genocide. They're accusing Israel of doing precisely what it is they want to have happen to Jews. And it's not always easy to defend those positions unless you've got adults that are on your side. And they have a lot of adults on their side. Professors who jump all in and say some of the nastiest stuff you can think of. You've got folks who are students from different countries who are just jumping on board. You've got staff members at the administration level who will do what they can to cover this all up. There's a professor by the name of Joseph Massad. I don't like his last name.
I was going to say, there's kind of an irony there.
There is some irony. It's almost like he's punishing himself. It's spelled differently, at least. It's M-A-S-S-A-D, but it's pronounced Massad. He made some pretty rotten statements in his capacity as a professor at Columbia. And today, it just so happened that the president of Columbia, Manoush Shafiq, I think is her name, was the latest to get in front of the Congress to defend all the anti-Semitism that's been going on college campuses. And I'm sure all of them now who step forward say, oh God, don't Claudine gay me. Please don't Claudine gay me. Please don't, please don't, please don't. And so they got to be very careful. I don't know if she was all that careful today. But here is Congressman Tim Walberg. He's a Republican from Michigan. Asking some basic questions about this particular professor.
The day after the October 7th attack, Professor Joseph Massad, and I only single him out amongst numerous others that I could single out, because he particularly is a tenured professor and chairs the School of Arts and Sciences Academic Review Committee. He wrote in an article praising, and I quote him, the innovative Palestinian resistance, end quote, for attacking Israel and glorifying Hamas's slaughter of nearly 1,200 Jews as, and I quote again, awesome, astonishing, astounding, and incredible.
Again, kind of on the same page as what the intent was. I think we all know where he stands. And so how does someone like that stay employed? I get the whole, everyone is entitled to their opinions. Yeah, but you don't have to hire Nazis, right? You don't have to hire white supremacists. You don't have to keep people whose viewpoints are dangerous. So how is it that he still has a job? Well, don't worry. He was given a stern talking to, and I'm sure he'll never hate Jews again.
Do you condemn Professor Massad's statement, and has he faced any consequences for it?
Congressman, I do condemn his statement. I am appalled by what he said.
Any consequences?
He has been spoken to.
So support of terrorism is acceptable if you're a Columbia professor?
Not at all. And I should say,
he's been spoken to.
I didn't get to fit. I
have your answer.
No. Yeah. You were a little too honest. You should have just lied. Oh, she does end up lying? The very next clip where she falsely claims that he no longer has a leadership role at Columbia University.
Do you stand behind Professor Massad remaining chair of the Academic Review Committee, giving his support for terrorism and harassing Jewish students?
Congressman Walberg, I just want to confirm that when faculty behave in any discriminatory fashion at Columbia...
You talk to him.
Get a mic cover,
no,
for God's sake.
We take them out of the classroom if necessary.
Is he out of the classroom?
From leadership posts if necessary. We allow students to leave those classes if they feel at all uncomfortable.
Is he out of the classroom?
He is, I believe, to answer your question, he is no longer chair of that committee and does not have a leadership role.
I love the idea that the student who's Jewish has to leave the class because of the anti-Semitic statements made by the professor. I just love that whole concept.
If you don't like the wholesale slaughter of Jews, you can just get up and leave.
I mean, look, we don't all have to be on the same page here. We can have a difference of opinion. You support Jews living, and I support them being genocided, okay? It's just a difference of opinion. And if you don't like it, you could leave. or I could kill you, because I guess that's kind of what we want anyway.
Try and meet in the middle, you know?
How do you meet in the middle? Some of them you kill? Like half of them? Now, what she just said there is not true, as Congresswoman Elise Stefanik pointed out.
But Mossad is still, in fact, listed on the Columbia website as chair of the Academic Review Committee. Are you aware of that?
I would need to check that. I don't want to misstate because he hasn't been removed as chair.
I
would like to confirm.
Do you have my commitment
he'll
be removed as chair today?
I have my commitment that I will come back to you and give you the facts.
So he hasn't been removed. So you said in front of Congress under oath
I am not sure.
He was removed.
I need to check. Here's the website. Oh, well, it could be an AI deepfake. No, it's not. We know exactly what he's still doing there. We really do. Now I'm just looking to see if there's been any update. No, no update yet. I'm sure they've taken him off the website, but that's about it. This is so disturbing. And, you know, it's sort of, I'm concerned that it's at a point where, because this is happening so often, these kinds of hearings, that they sort of get lost. It's kind of just noise in the background. It's like, oh, another college president defending anti-Semitism, showing how feckless they are. Did we do this story yesterday? Did we do it last week? I fear that that's going to start, if it hasn't already started, I think that that's going to happen. And, you know, kind of seems like an important issue, especially if you're a parent. You don't have to be Jewish, but a parent of a college-age student who's going to go to one of these universities? My God. 1-800-465-8770 for your text messages. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
Wake up, lazy. Get up at 6 a.m. and join us and learn whether or not a well-trained crew of thieves is taking down legal pot growths in the South Sound. Thursday morning on The Brian Suit Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
A man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
You keep on bringing these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
Right now, there's a pilot program underway in the city of Seattle. And if it's successful, could potentially change policing, not just in Seattle, but really all around the region. It's a dual dispatch where members of the CARE team, stands for Community Assisted Response and Engagement. They help officers handle the nonviolent cases where someone is dealing with some kind of crisis, persons in crisis. We're talking about, in a lot of cases, though not always, folks who are homeless, folks who are dealing with a mental health crisis. And it could go in a way that gets embraced in a much bigger way. Certainly, that's what they're hoping for over at the CARE team, which is run by Chief Amy Smith, who joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So generally speaking, when we're talking about someone in crisis, especially in the context of the pilot program, for the most part, it sounds like we're potentially dealing with people who are either homeless and or dealing with some mental health issues.
Yeah, that's right. Those are the most common calls for service.
So take us through how the program works specifically.
Yeah, so the CARE team responders are on police channels, listening to the same radio. And when calls come in to 911, which I also have oversight of, if they are screened to be low priority, low acuity, so priority 3 or 4, we know somebody needs help, somebody some risk. You know, we see folks wandering through traffic, muttering sometimes, or crying, or in some kind of distress that doesn't look like it's overdose. We don't see any weapons, any concern about violence. Then the team is dispatched downtown. So it's between 11 a.m. to 2300, 11 p.m. But they're dispatched at the same time as police. And so generally, police show up. They can be there for just a minute. You know, it basically is the police co-response model, but I've got two different vehicles so that police can say, are you good here? You know, clear the scene, and then they move on to another call. So my primary objective is to get cops to high acuity calls. I've got to get folks out to priority 1 within 7 minutes. Right now I can't do it. There's just too many calls for service.
And that's obviously been an issue that has plagued this department and really just the city for several years. Yeah. Obviously started around COVID and really had to do with, I think, the BLM movement kind of pushed cops out. And the staffing situation, right, especially amongst patrol officers, we have the HR numbers we went over last week. I mean, you're just talking about a little over 430 patrol officers who can work. And obviously, yeah, they're not all working at the same time. So I had the opportunity to do a ride along with the CARE team a few weeks back just to see generally how it worked. And one thing that seems to be clear, and it's a potential issue certainly in the short term, is an officer, it sounds like, has to ask for a CARE team member to come out to a call, correct?
Well, they can be dispatched at the same time, or they can go in secondary response mode, which is when the officer is requesting. So it just kind of depends on availability. And we're still figuring out the screening process. Mm-hmm. You know, in dispatch, I mean, they were part of SPD. And so it is a novel concept for folks inside the system to think about having another resource that's, you know, a master's level behavioral health specialist. All of my folks have already worked in crisis response for years. You know, two were CSOs. But that's part of it, getting buy-in and dispatch to know, no, we're being very cautious about this. You know, it is very valid, I think, the fear of sending unarmed responders to calls right now. That's a valid fear. I know there's a lot of fear, you know, inside the fire department as well, because mm-hmm. The side effects of fentanyl are unprecedented. It is different out there right now. And so I'm always very quick to acknowledge that. So, yeah, sometimes we're just dispatching primarily, you know, the CARE team goes out, but then very often we're not getting the protocols right. I'm sending cops to a call. They get there. They're like, this is not for us. Mm-hmm. We do not need to be here. And they'll call on CARE, or they'll call on a community service officer, a CSO. There's wild overlap. I mean, both units can do a lot of the same types of work.
I got the impression that officers were not yet really utilizing the services to the extent, I think, that the department would hope for. Is that still a general case?
Yeah, I think it's actually not being used to the extent that police command hope for.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm feeling I'm a little bit more patient with the rollout because I know it is a new concept and we're trying things out. We're figuring out, it's almost like choreography, you know, how best to do this. Are there calls that CARE should just go to, especially for mm-hmm. high utilizers? We already know someone. But there's a lot of urgency in police command. You know, I hear Chief Diaz, Chief Barden, Chief Maxey, lots of people saying, you need to use this resource. You know, it's here now. They're good. They know what they're doing. Use it. And we're also working to make sure that we articulate the role of the community service officers and just other resources we have in the system. You know, I'm talking a lot to people who are in outreach work, who are in diversion, to figure out, can I have lots of different co-response type models?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can I just contract with different teams who have different types of specialization, either go out with officers or with the CARE team?
It does seem, though, that officers, especially the ones I talk to, seem reluctant to call CARE over. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it's the same general concern of that anyone might have of sending someone who's unarmed to a potentially volatile situation.
Yeah.
I mean, even when you've got a general sense that things are not going to get violent, there's no guarantee of that.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting because I get often, I don't hear that resistance, but it's because people aren't going to say it to me.
Yeah, they won't tell you. They'll tell me.
Yeah, when officers are seeking me out. Yeah, exactly. And I totally accept that. So it's been fun to get around the roll calls, and I'm always level setting that I understand how my department was organized. I understand that this pilot was framed to be antagonistic toward cops. I just got here a year ago. I do not see it that way at all. And I think I'm uniquely poised to comment, you mm-hmm. know, on the work of officers. I'm in 911. I am watching and listening and observing around the clock. And so I think that's part of it. You know, I'm just wrapping up a year, and I think people are starting to believe that I absolutely mean what I'm saying. I am convinced that this is the right philosophy to design with police and with fire. And I feel like if we had just set up a third department, like in the 60s, when we started seeing a lot of mental health crises,
yep.
you know, we started seeing more PTSD, more dependency, you know, the domestic disputes that were nonviolent in nature. Like, what if we just started sending social workers then? I think that would have been such a better approach, which would have reduced this burden that was always on officers, you know, to respond to virtually every single concern in community. Like, that is just an irrational design. It would be horrible for any human to feel like they had to have every single skill from every profession. And that's basically sure. how it's been.
we're talking with Chief Amy Smith. In addition to running, overseeing the department for 911 calls, she's overseeing this new pilot program. It's a dual dispatch program where members of a non-police team go out into the field dealing with some folks who are dealing with a crisis. Right now, there's some significant limitations because it's part of a pilot program. And as I was thinking about writing through my experiences when I was on this ride along, there was one point that just kept coming in my head, which was, in a lot of ways, it feels like because of the amount of rules that are involved, and even though I totally understand it, it's almost like it was designed to fail in that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there has to be some level of, I don't know if aggression is the right word, but you know, got to be proactive. And you know, I'm seeing that you can't proactively approach someone who's homeless and in the streets and clearly is in need of, you know, some kind of intervention outside of obviously an emergency where someone's getting an overdose, needs Narcan. But outside of that, just walking by and being present is important, but not being able to be proactive is a bit of a head scratcher to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I was pretty naive coming in. I've never been around bureaucracy at all. You know, I've been at these generally smaller, mid-sized, very nimble nonprofits where as fast as you can get the funding and have a proper philosophy and academic premise, you go to work, you know, and we have to design in a way, like, I don't know what this team can or should do until I get out there and start trying things and see where the need is. And so I've realized, you know, that, and I think it's not just Seattle government. I think it's everywhere. It's like we want to sit in a boardroom and design a perfect thing, but that's not how it works. And as fast as we figure one thing out, we're seeing it right now with fentanyl, right? We hadn't even figured out meth at all. and then fentanyl came online, and we didn't, like in supportive housing and some of these environments, we didn't contemplate a smoked drug, basically. You know, we really didn't. We weren't prepared for that. And now I'm seeing, you know, now we've got Trank, and we don't know how to respond to that. And so I do feel urgency around, you know, acting and designing, being really transparent about what appears to be working and what's not working. And to your point, yeah, you cannot stipulate, you know, every single tiny minute detail of a pilot that's intended to respond to crisis, because every situation is different. And it took me a few months to realize call types don't even matter, actually. They really don't. They're premised on what somebody's observing, what they're guessing. And what's really interesting from a research perspective is what did it turn out to be, right? Yeah. What did we think it was? We are typing things incorrectly all the time. And in 911, you know, last year there was over 5,500 person down two priority types and fewer than 200, I think, priority three down types. And I just knew, because I walk around downtown, that is not right. That is not right. That is presuming all of these folks who are napping and muttering and, you know, that they're all violent. No, they're not. But it made a lot of sense to me that in 911, they're making things too so that somebody will go, because I don't have enough officers. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so it's I think it also brings up two important points here. Number one, you know, to a certain degree, you're not really ever going to fix a poorly observed 911 call, right? I mean, if I'm calling 911, it's not because I'm, you know, trained to look for certain things. It's just what I think I see in the moment. But number two, you know, you're also dealing with the fact that it's also true that just because we think something might be priority three or priority four doesn't mean it actually is priority three or priority four. And you know this, have one screw up in which one of your care team members gets harmed or worse, then the entire program is going to be called out and probably go away.
Yep. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, we see that precedent everywhere, and I'm always trying to level set and be very candid. Anyone could be hurt. Anyone could be shot. I mean, kind of in this country, but certainly in the city right now. We have first responders who are harmed all the time, and it is tragic, and we do everything we can to design against that. But this happens, again, I'm from a social work background and, you know, I've been in a lot of environments that were fraught, and I still am. You know, I'm basically looking at crime and crisis hotspots, and I'm hanging out there to try to understand what's happening. I assume a level of risk to do the work that I'm doing. I try to manage that risk, but the proper response is just to train people to be nimble, to be improvisational, to really understand, like, when you have a new drug come online, how does that show up? I feel a lot less safe now than I did 10 years ago. because I can see by the data, behaviors are way more erratic and it's a lot more random, you know, what we're seeing. It used to be, I hear people often talk about, you know, folks who are unsheltered and they weren't seen to be a threat generally, right? You grew up and you were used to seeing the same few people hanging out in an area and it was largely just benign, sad perhaps, but not something that we were scared of. And so things are different right now. I mean, Jason, at the end of the day, I care so much about people. I really do. I care about all the people. I know I've got to get folks indoors. People should not be dying on the streets. They shouldn't be smoking fentanyl on the corner and overdosing. And I can see it's going to happen again tomorrow and the next day and the next day. Mm-hmm. It cannot be like this, you know, and I do know I've got to do something to support law enforcement right now. I liked when you published those patrol numbers because I knew that.
Yep.
But I don't think people understand what we've actually done. And when I am sitting in 911, the scarcity, just seeing it on the monitor, it's really upsetting, really problematic.
Last question for you, and maybe this is a little in the weeds, so don't give me an in the weeds answer because otherwise people will tune out. But do you think that if the 911 call center was not removed from SPD, this would go a little bit differently in at least being accepted by cops, because you are now a third party essentially, and it was kind of removed in a very political way. I think there's no doubt about that. It was very clearly politically motivated. And so, you know, you might just not be seen as part of the team, and whether or not that's fair doesn't really matter if that's the perception. So what do you think the roles would look like? We have about a minute left. If you were back in with SPD under SPD leadership?
Yeah, I think in the short run, it would have been easier. There's no question. I think in the long run, I am so useful to SPD. I think, and to fire too, because I am outside the system commenting objectively, empirically on the system and what's needed. You know, and I think having that voice impartially, you know, and objectively just talking about the problems and potential solutions, it's really powerful. You know, that's been one of the most meaningful parts of last year was being able to go to roll calls to say, I acknowledge this, I see this, you know, and also the community does too. I'm in tons of community meetings surfacing what it is that we're actually seeing, whether it's about, you know, fentanyl or it's about housing or people don't understand, you know, being arrested, that doesn't mean being booked, right?
Correct.
And outpatient treatment won't work for this thing. And, you know, juveniles, nope, you have to be caught with a firearm five times. You know, there's a lot of different things that people just don't understand. And so I think we got a little bit lucky that I have the temperament that I do and I am who I am, because I think if you had a different leader come in that was very antagonistic toward the system, I think it would have been a mess.
No kidding. And you leak something unintentionally, not leak necessarily, but people don't realize that juveniles have to get caught basically five times with a gun before it even registers within the city and county.
I had to fact check that. Yeah. Like I could not believe that. And that's, again, at a state level that needs to change. But you can do a story about that for sure.
Oh, yes. Well, believe me, that story is in my draft box right now. We've been talking with Chief Amy Smith. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And obviously, we're going to be keeping an eye on this and see how it develops over the next several months.
Yeah, thanks for the good questions and interest.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. When we come back, we're going to dive into some quick hits.
The Jason Rand Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
Well, we have a bit of an update, a pretty significant update, if you ask me, out of NPR, where Uri Berliner, that senior editor who called out NPR for being so one-sided, he, yesterday we told you, was suspended for a week without pay. He learned of that suspension on Friday of last week. Well, now we can tell you he has decided, rather than accept the punishment that kind of deserved, I'll tell you why in a second, but he decided to step down. He resigned. He said, yeah, no, I'm out. Now, NPR isn't commenting on the resignation. Instead, they basically did what we normally get, which we don't comment on individual personnel decisions, even though they're the ones who put out the whole suspension to begin with. Now, which is just weird. So this is an interesting, you know, tactic for him to take, and I think it's totally well warranted. And as I said yesterday, I 100% agree with every bit of his assessment of NPR. All of his criticism is 100% correct. However, you are also not allowed to do things like that publicly, and you will suffer some consequences. But if I were him and I did exactly what he would do, I would also resign after being punished. Because understand that if he was less critical, he would not have been punished. Understand that if he were less critical or as critical and it didn't get picked up nationally the way that it did, he wouldn't be punished at all. He made a decision that was best for him. I don't know if I could work at a place that I just didn't have any respect for and didn't believe what they were doing was right. I'm in a little bit of a different position in the sense that KTDH is a conservative talk station, right? So, you know, if all of a sudden they told us we couldn't be conservative anymore and they're just going to be a left wing, yeah, I would leave in a heartbeat. I would leave in a heartbeat. And if they told us what kind of conservative I had to be, what positions I had to take, I wouldn't feel comfortable working here. They don't do that. And I never feel pressure to take on any particular position other than whatever is my natural one for fear that either I might not fit in or I might get canned. At NPR, people can't say that. You get canned if you're not a left-wing hardcore activist. You won't even get hired unless you're that. And you've got a CEO in Catherine Marr. She's their newish CEO over at NPR. And, you know, people have been calling out her tweets from years ago, not even that long ago. It was really during the BLM movement where she's all about cracking down on white supremacy culture, blah, 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 blah. Well, there was a video that was resurfaced today where she made some interesting comments about the First Amendment at the Open Summit 360 convention. And let's listen in to see whether or not her framing around taking on disinformation in a world of social media. Let's see if her framing is problematic or if maybe she was just sort of sloppy with some of her word choice. Again, the context is taking on a fight against disinformation or misinformation.
The number one challenge here that we see and is, of course, the First Amendment in the United States is a fairly robust protection of rights. And that is a protection of rights both for platforms, which I actually think is very important that platforms have those rights to be able to regulate what kind of content they want on their sites. But it also means that it is a little bit tricky to really address some of the real challenges of where does bad information come from and sort of the influence peddlers who have made a real market economy around it.
So number one, fix your Wi-Fi. Number two, I'm not going to hit her too hard on this one because I understand what she's saying. Now, perhaps when we get more context of this video, but since this was the leaked video, I'm assuming this is all the context they want us to hear, the ones who are critical. On this, she gets a little bit of a pass because I want to just be fair. I maybe wouldn't frame it using the same language because it could sound as if she is saying the First Amendment is a problem in a general sense. But I think what she means is that because we have First Amendment rights, it's more difficult to find or limit misinformation and disinformation. And look, at the end of the day, I would like to limit misinformation or disinformation. That doesn't mean you're anti-First Amendment. How you go about limiting or trying to prevent the mis or disinformation, or even how you define misinformation or disinformation, that could make you an enemy of the First Amendment. Maybe. Again, it all depends on the particular. So I'm going to look at me. I'm being very nice to her, even though I find her to be a lunatic based on a lot of her tweets. I don't think this one is a big to-do. Now, it's still being released in the context of some what I think are pretty bad optics for NPR. And the Uri Berliner decision just makes it seem like NPR is even more intolerant than a lot of folks on the right already knew it to be. The question is, do folks on the left or people who are more moderate, do they look at NPR the exact same way? Because the only reason why that would matter to me is that then we can maybe get enough support to pull government funding for NPR, which it should not, even if it was a hardcore conservative outlet, they should not be getting government funds. But you got to convince enough members of Congress to take on that position. And Democrats just as a whole aren't going to want to do that because they benefit from NPR. But you've got just enough moderate Democrats who could probably be convinced to go with Republicans on this. I don't know if this is going to, this video is for certain not going to do it, but we'll see what else ends up happening over the coming days. Cause I feel like there's going to be much more to the turmoil over the partisanship over at NPR, but we'll find out. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.